Well, thank you, Jim. It's really an honor to be a part of this program this evening to recognize the many contributions of Gordon Dickerson to the beef cattle industry. Jim didn't mention who inherited those small animals after he got rid of them, but I will, since Larry Olson is here, I should mention that Larry and I, working with small animals, that's a euphemism for rats, and sheep for our master's degrees, determined that if we pooled our scarce resources, we might be able to buy a cow. And for our PhDs, Larry would do a dissertation on the cow, and I would do one on analyzing data with no degrees of freedom. It didn't quite turn out that way, although sometimes it seemed as though it might. Nebraska was a tremendously exciting place to be in the early 1970s. Working with Gordon, with Mark just really coming into its own as a tremendous resource, a tremendous research center, it was really a privilege. It was partly a privilege because Gordon, more than anyone I know, could pick up a problem and turn it around and see all the complexities and all the possibilities in it. But it was also important because more than anyone else I know, he took very seriously the development of his students and their growth. He took very seriously his commitment to the livestock industry, and he took very seriously the welfare of his fellow man. And I just think all of us who were there at the time probably hoped that we took away a small part of that. Now, Gordon was a patient man, but I think by now he would suggest that we ought to get on with it. And I'm going to do that. The topic I've been asked to speak about, defining the biological efficiency of beef production, I'm not going to deal much historically because I don't have to, because much of Gordon's work is very, very pertinent to what's going on today. And so I'm going to try and draw those connections. The efficiency of beef production is a fairly overused and poorly defined term. We hold it up like an ideal, like something we're searching for and hope to discover. We don't do a very good job of making it something tangible that we measure and select for and improve. We've tried to do that for a long time. We're going to get what I expect to be some wonderful suggestions in the next 2 days on how to do that. Separating the economic and the biological efficiency is impossible. It's especially impossible in ruminants, where we rely on cheap forages produced on less productive land as a trade-off to compensate for the inherent inefficiency of the rumen in using concentrate feeds. It's also impossible to not talk about economic efficiency when we have a pricing system, a value system, that rewards both fatness and leanness at the same time. Fortunately, I can defer those discussions of economic efficiency to Dr. Tess and try and limit my talk to biological efficiency, which I'm going to define this way: the capacity to convert physical inputs, primarily feed, into marketable product, primarily beef, under prevailing production conditions. My nod to the economics of how we produce livestock. But it would be wrong to consider that biological efficiency is a characteristic only of an animal. It's also a characteristic of an industry. And therefore, we need to include in our definition of biological efficiency those population characteristics that provide flexibility to rapidly adjust the characteristics of commercial offspring in response to changes in economic conditions. The beef industry experiences economic change at a pace far greater than anything we can do genetically. We can't adapt fast enough to tailor animals to the prevailing economic conditions. Instead, we have to hold on to the flexibility, the breed diversity, the genetic resources to allow the industry to maintain biological and economic efficiency no matter what the conditions we may be confronted with. When we think about efficiency of beef production, we normally break it into two pieces: cow efficiency and growth efficiency, or the growth of the growing animal. The efficiency of the growing animal. We're doing that quite a bit in the next 2 days. We do it in part because those two pieces seem so distinct. The things that make a cow efficient and valuable are at best fairly independent of the things that make a steer growing in the feedlot efficient and profitable. We look at this set of traits on the slide, and I think these are some of the biological characteristics that are necessary to permit efficient production. Different mixes, different packages, but most of the pieces here are the biological traits that we need to make economic efficiency happen. Cow efficiency includes several things. I've focused on these four, and I'm going to cut the focus down even farther very soon. We have to have a certain level of performance in the cow herd for the traits that make calves profitable: growth, leanness, those sorts of things. We need calving ease because calving ease permits crossbreeding. And if there was one thing I learned from Gordon in considerable detail, it was that crossbreeding is probably our most efficient way to produce meat of any sort. Maintenance requirements are a big piece of cow efficiency. This may be the blackest of black boxes because we need to know an estimate of individual feed intake. We'll get some ideas in the next few days of that. We know now that there is variation in cow maintenance requirements, but it's not an area we can take on very well yet. In reading Gordon's papers, though, when preparing this talk, the thing that comes out loud and clear, first thing in talking about the efficiency of beef production, is reproductive efficiency. We know that the high costs of cow feed and the low reproductive rate of the cow mean that the greatest opportunity we have is in improving reproductive efficiency. The main two ways we might do that is maintaining high herd fertility, and we've not done a very good job of attempting to do that genetically. We don't really record the data we need, with the exception of a few breed associations. We rely on the innate high fertility in most of our herds, and that's a blessing for us. But if you look at tropical work in Australia, tropical work in Brazil, it's very clear that we can improve fertility of beef cows when we need to. We're fortunate in our environments we often don't need to. The other possibility, more controversial, involves the increasing the fecundity of the beef cow. In essentially all the papers I read, which Gordon addresses this issue, very early this comes up. The only real way we can increase the reproductive efficiency of cows in a major way is through twinning. Obviously that message got through. It got through to people like Keith Gregory and his colleagues, Cheryl Echternkamp and others at the Meat Animal Research Center, and had its realization and development of a line selected for twinning at the Meat Animal Research Center. This is a diagram of the genetic progress in that line, the changes in twinning rate over time, and it reminds me of a comment my colleague Bill Hohenbogh liked to make. If you can measure it, and if there's variation in it, you can change it. And obviously that's the case for twinning. That line, at last count, and I may need to get an update, was somewhere over 35% twinners. Now, for someone looking at twinning from outside the beef industry, this looks a little like the Holy Grail. What would be better than doubling or nearly doubling the reproductive rate of the beef cow? So why haven't we embraced that? Well, here's some reasons, among others. The performance of cows producing twins, we see greater dystocia in twin births, especially in adult cows, actually. And that's telling us that the problem isn't a calf that's too big. It's a couple calves that are just too friendly and have to be separated before they can find their way out. Postpartum conception is reduced in cows that produce twins. Days to conception is extended. But the calves weaned per cow calving goes up about 60%. The weight of calf per cow calving goes up about 60%. That's the kind of increase in efficiency it's hard to ignore. Twin-born calves weigh less at birth. They live a little less easily in the first few days of life or the first few weeks of life. They weigh less when they're weaned, but they take a little bit longer to reach slaughter, and they weigh very little less at slaughter. So the realization or the cost of producing those twins comes very quickly. It comes right about the time of birth and in the time involved in rebreeding the cows. If we do a few simple calculations looking at overall effects of twinning on the efficiency of beef production, the estimated calves weaned per cow exposed derived from the results on the twinner herd at mark look like about 0.7 calves in single births and about 1.02 in twin births. And I know you all think those should be higher, and many of you know they really aren't. Slaughter weights, not different. Slaughter weight per cow exposed then becomes about 41% higher in cows producing twins. Now, one of the advantages of working with sheep is you know they won't all be twins. The best you can do before the triplets start to come, at least in sheep, is about 60% twins. So this might be a goal we could achieve in the beef industry. And at a maximum of 60% twin births, herd cow efficiency, or the pounds of calf at slaughter per cow exposed, increases by about 25%. Now think about how excited we get about 4% heterosis for calf weaning weight. And I think that will help put this in perspective. Now, this has been done before, not surprisingly. Gordon and one of his master's students took data from Cal Davis on artificial twinning, twinning induced hormonally, and predicted about a 79% increase in output per cow calving, an increase of about 69% in output per cow exposed, the cost of production predicted to be reduced by about 24% in cows that twin. So why don't we do it? Part of the reason we don't do it is the cost and maybe more importantly, the availability of labor. We still operate with cows that are predominantly scavengers. So the economics comes, Mike. I'm not going to try and juggle that, but I think it's important to understand we have a marvelous opportunity, which we may or may not choose to use, to increase biological efficiency of beef production. Let me now move to growth efficiency. And when we do that, we open up a real spider's web of interactions among these traits: appetite, lean growth potential, shape of the growth curve, maintenance, body composition. All of these things interacting and interacting in fairly complex ways to determine the efficiency of an animal growing after weaning. One of the advantages of those complexities is we never are at a lack of new ideas about how to try to express that. Some of them new, some of them not so new. Feed conversion ratio is a traditional way of measuring the efficiency of the growing calf. The pounds of feed required for gain over some period, usually the period from weaning until slaughter at an appropriate slaughter endpoint. We know a little bit about this trait now. We know that it requires rapid gain. Almost never can a calf that is not gaining rapidly achieve a favorable feed conversion ratio. It is fairly permissive of high feed intake. The relationship between feed efficiency and feed intake is generally one in which high efficiency favors low intake. The relationship is not tight. Animals with high intake and high growth potential can show rather favorable feed efficiency. Feed conversion ratio is generally favors leaner gains. But now we get a big caveat. Leaner gains at the same overall gain, leaner gains at the same feed intake. Being lean by eating less and growing less doesn't produce efficient growth in most cases. And this is why I think we see at best a very moderate relationship between composition of the animal and feed conversion ratio. Feed conversion ratio would clearly be improved by lower maintenance requirements so long as the animal with lower maintenance requirements can still gain at the same rate. And that's a somewhat open question. It's not clear that animals with lower maintenance requirements, lower basal metabolic rates, can gain at the same rates. Now again, this is a topic that was probably handled as well as it's ever been in a 1974 paper by Gordon and his colleagues on selecting for efficiency of beef production. One of the few papers that has ever produced a selection index for beef cattle that was actually applied in some sectors of the industry. And again, did more probably to help us understand this than most papers we've had. We've got some new ideas for measuring efficient feed use, and we'll hear about them the next couple of days. Dave Johnson's got some things to share from down under. Again, not so much new under the sun. Bob Cook in 1963 suggested the difference between actual feed intake and expected feed requirement might be a good measure of efficiency of production. Among animals of the same size and the same growth rate, There is still variation in efficiency of feed use. Can we capture that as something intrinsic in the way animals grow? Recent developments in residual feed intake have come from Australia primarily, where Arthur talks about the actual measured feed intake minus that predicted by regression on metabolic mean weight and average daily gain as an indicator of efficiency of growth in the feedlot animal. And Arthur goes further to suggest that residual feed intake should be the preferred trait for genetic improvement of post-weaning feed efficiency. I'll share a set of parameters here that show some of the differences between these two measures of efficient feed use. Feed conversion ratio and residual feed intake are positively correlated. They are, in some sense, two sides of the same coin. Feed conversion ratio most strongly relates to growth. Fast-growing calves are efficient calves when efficiency is measured by the feed conversion ratio. Residual feed intake, almost by definition, is near independent of average weight and near independent of average daily gain, but it has an equally strong relationship with feed intake. Again, changing the terms of the debate just a bit to talk about residual feed intake favoring animals that particularly consume less feed. You'll notice that back fat thickness, our measure of composition in these data, is not extremely highly correlated with any of these things, suggesting that cattle can be efficient in many ways in many different packages. While we're looking at quotes, I'll share this one with you. Sometimes proposed that individual deviations of feed consumption from regression would measure efficiency better than the feed gain ratio. Such deviations ignore the efficiency of animals which use more feed for growth. Just because animals use feed, increase feed consumption to grow faster, doesn't make them inefficient. So there are two pieces to efficient growth. High intake, high growth, high lean efficiency, and perhaps another more innate piece of growth measured by a characteristic like the residual feed intake. This is not a novel or new idea. It's a quote from Gordon's paper in 1970 on efficiency of animal production. As we look at these different measures of feed intake, relative feed intake provides an alternative measure of feed intake, which may be more nearly independent of gain than feed conversion ratio. It's a nice way to look at feed intake. How much feed does that animal eat relative to what we think it should have eaten to perform at this level? That's a useful measure. That's not the only measure. And it's likely that relative feed intake still will have to be combined with other measures of growth rate and composition to give us a full picture of the efficiency of growth. It may be conceptually useful. It is probably not sufficient alone as a measure of feed efficiency. And we'll have adequate time in the next 2 days to bat that topic back and forth. And I look forward to that conversation. I want to talk a bit about appetite and growth curves. One of the things that was a hot topic when I arrived in Lincoln in the early 1970s was genetic variation in the growth curve and whether there were genetic differences in the pattern of growth that animals followed. Many of you remember those discussions extremely well. The consensus, if there was one, is that there's very little variation in the shape of the growth curve. And the role of appetite in modifying that was not really thought of too much. See here. Here we go. Now, however, we know very clearly from data in broilers and to some extent in pigs that the growth curve is under genetic control. This is a set of growth curves for broiler males produced from animals born in the 50s, the mid-70s, and the current day. While it suffers from all the problems that come with trying to compare data taken 25 years apart, it's clear, I think, that the growth curve of the broiler chicken has changed and changed radically in the past 50 years. If we look at the parameters of the curve, we see the mature weight of broiler males has increased about 75%. Looking over on the right side of the table, growth rate at 1.5 kilograms has quadrupled in 50 years. Maturing rate has also increased. Now, for those of you who are students of Claire Taylor, students of growth, bigger animals are supposed to mature more slowly. Bigger broilers mature faster. And I think we can only conclude that intensive selection for rapid early growth has indeed allowed us to bend the growth curve. It's allowed us to change the pattern of growth in these animals. Some very interesting work with swine suggests that the growth pattern of the terminal sire lines in swine has been changed perhaps substantially, with little increases in mature size, but fairly large increases in lean growth rate. To bring this closer to home, the recent report from the Meat Animal Research Center on the current germplasm evaluation cycle using current industry bulls of the seven breeds shown here show us some things about growth patterns that are extremely intriguing. Now, before I focus on these, I realize that this is a somewhat busy slide. It's a little bit hard to follow. And so I'm going to take a page from Gordon and try and give you some highlighting that might make this easier to follow. Surely it does, doesn't it? The points I want to make is that as we look from top to bottom, moving from our traditional British breeds to the continental breeds, we see the average daily gains in the feedlot of those animals really not differing very much at all. And some of the breeds that are on the low end of the scale are not the breeds we would have expected to find there based on our traditional view of their adult size and their maturing rates. Looking on the right, however, we find that retail product lines up just the way we expect it to, with the European breeds, the continental European breeds, consistently higher in retail product than the British breeds. We'll have to wait, Larry, for a while to see what the frame sizes and adult weights of these animals are going to be. But I think we may well be seeing a manifestation of appetite differences in the growth achieved by the British breeds in this chart. I think that appetite may be a powerful way in which we can modify growth curves, a powerful way in which we can increase average daily gains, and I do not know at what risk of increased fatness we do that. We do know that the broiler industry no longer selects exclusively on early growth. The broiler industry no longer does that because they became created birds that were excessively fat. Now, we have a very different picture. This appetite, if it produces fat in the form of marbling, has potential to give us the best of both worlds. Whether it shall or not, we'll have to wait and see. I thought I'd be remiss without opening this can of worms because I think it's a very fun can of worms to open. And besides, I'm almost done and then I can go away. The myostatin gene, double muscling. We now know something about double muscling more than we did before. We know it results from a simple mutation in the myostatin gene that has a regulatory role in muscle growth. We know that there are two different mutations in that gene resulting in double muscling in the Belgian Blue and the Piedmontese. While they are different mutations, they are functionally, as far as we know, nearly equivalent. Both have been identified. Both can be identified by DNA testing. Both show up in the darndest places sometimes. The effects of a single copy of an inactive myostatin allele raise some potential for increasing the biological efficiency of beef production that, like twinning, we cannot ignore. We might choose not to use, but we cannot ignore. If we look at the effects, and I've drawn these from the paper by Short and all, which I think is one of the more definitive papers, there are several others that are not greatly different from this. most notably from Casas at Meat Animal Research Center. A single copy of an inactive myostatin allele increases birth weight by about 3 pounds, and that is about the smallest increase that's been reported. Others say more. Increases dystocia by about 30% in heifers, which suggests it's a bad idea. Has no effect in this data in adult cows. No effect on weaning or post-weaning gain. An increase in dressing percentage of almost 2%. An increase in lean yield of just over 2%, dropping the yield grade by 0.6 units. These cattle were, I believe, about 50% double-muscled breed, 50% Hereford. The marbling score was reduced by one copy of a myostatin, inactive myostatin allele by 0.6 of a unit, which would move the percent choice in that data from about 88% to about 68%. Not a trivial decline. The efficiency of gain, traditional feed conversion ratio, was reduced by 2.7% because these animals did actually gain slightly less rapidly. But the increase in lean gain efficiency was almost 5%. The data here looks no more discouraging to me than that we might achieve from terminal sire crossbreeding of a moderately sized cow to a large sire breed. Two copies become a bit more problematical. Two copies of inactive myostatin allele, birth weight goes up about 10 pounds. Dystocia goes up to 7% in adult cows. Weaning and post-weaning gain actually decline. Dressing percentage goes up by 5%. Lean yield goes up by about 6%, reducing yield grade by 2 full units. Marbling score is correspondingly reduced by 2 units, which essentially moved all of those cattle out of USDA choice. However, as we think about tenderness of product, there is little, if any, data to suggest that the tenderness of meat from these animals is not at least as good as that of animals that carry the 2 normal myostatin alleles. So we have a bit of an anomaly where these animals, of course, do not fit our grading system, but are not in any sense necessarily undesirable to the consumer. So why don't we look at these myostatin mutations? Low marbling, yes, is a concern, and it probably means that we will have to think about novel ways of marketing product from these animals if we are to use them. Dystocia increased in heifers and perhaps young cows, but again, this should not be an insurmountable issue with one copy of the myostatin gene in terminal sire crossbreeding. So again, like twinning, an opportunity to have a rather significant impact on the biological efficiency of beef production. Let me leave you with some issues that we might wish to think about over the next couple of days. One, is high lean gain potential going to be associated with high basal metabolic rates? We know that high dairy merit in all species appears to be associated with higher metabolic rates. Is the same true of high lean gain? Will we be able to have individuals with high lean gain potential that also may be efficient as a part of a cow herd? We know, I think without question, from work in Australia, that there is variation, genetic variation in maintenance requirements of individuals. We know from work with experimental animals, Merlin Nielsen's work at Nebraska, that there is genetic variation in basal metabolic rate. We know from Wayne Wyatt's PhD dissertation at Virginia Tech that activity levels can have major impacts on metabolic rates. I'd answer this question with my best guess as a probably not. I'd use 2 pieces of information to do that. If I look at the information on cow efficiency involving the Charolais, it is almost invariably not bad to good. If I look on the other side of my area of work at the Texel sheep, a very lean animal that appears to have very low maintenance requirements as an adult ewe. So we have some opportunities here. Is there meaningful variation in maintenance requirements? Yes, I'm certain there is. How we're going to measure them, I do not know. I'll rely on Dave Johnson and some of the Australians to share some strategies. What about appetite? Is appetite a good thing or is appetite a bad thing? In the meat type pig, appetite's a bad thing primarily. Till recently, it was a bad thing. In cattle, where we reward percent choice, appetite's probably a good thing. Is fatness just appetite? Are the fat cattle just the cattle that overeat? Can we synchronize an animal's lean growth potential with its appetite? We know lean growth potential drops over time. Why should not appetite drop over time in concert? Does that happen? And can we find animals that will have favorable relationships between appetite, lean gain, and efficiency? It won't be easy, and we'll have to measure feed. So is there variation in shape of the growth curve? Yes, probably. Is it appetite related? Yes, probably. How will we use it? Well, there's always next year to argue about that. I'll close now. As I said, I want to thank Jim for the opportunity to do this. I want to thank all of you for your presence tonight as a part of this celebration. And I think probably we'll keep moving, Jim, rather than do questions now. Is that the plan?
That'd be fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much.